This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
My golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Zach Moore, and the Chief is off this week, but we have a very special guest with us today, writer, director, actor, Mr. John Lee Brody. What's up, John? Welcome to the podcast, man.
What's going on, Zach? Thank you for having me. That's quite the intro you gave me. Hopefully I live up to that hype. Fingers crossed on that.
I'm a man of many hats, right?
If I learn to figure skate, then I can literally do almost everything, but I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it.
So John and I actually connected via my Smallville podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville. As you guys hear me plug every week here on the network, I have another podcast.
Wait, what's the name of that podcast again? Just one more time.
It's called Always Hold On to Smallville. You can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S. Also follow our Facebook page.
Maybe say it one more time just in case people didn't get it.
Yeah, so that's Always Hold On to Smallville, folks. I want to be very clear about this. But anyway, so John's a big Smallville fan, and he's going to be on the Smallville podcast down the road here. But as far as Star Trek goes, John has some serious cred that most of us really can only dream about. He's appeared on screen as a Starfleet officer in a Star Trek movie. So we'll get into that down the line. But long story short, man, you were a security guard with a red shirt, and you didn't die. So good job.
Yeah, you know, it's spoiler alert in case anyone hasn't seen Star Trek Into Darkness. If you haven't, then why are you listening to this podcast? Because I would assume you'd be pretty up to speed. You don't see me die. I mean, we don't know what happens off screen, but I'm assuming that I lived and maybe moved on to greener pastures or something. Maybe I moved to Iowa and I took over, you know, Kirk's stepfather's car dealership or whatever. I don't know. that's some fan fiction for you right there that you guys can rack your brain around.
That's great. Well, we'll get into your time on the Enterprise later on in the conversation. But to start out, let's go back to the beginning. How did you first get into the whole show business thing, man? Is it something you've always wanted to do, or what's the story there?
You know, the thing I always wanted to do, I grew up in Chicago. So, I mean, that's a very sports heavy town. And I grew up in the 90s, so that's, you know, the Michael Jordan, you know, era. So I wanted to be in the NBA. That was my dream. That was my number one goal. And I didn't get there, obviously. I'm not Jeremy Lin, in case people were wondering. So
Lin.
just not to profile myself, that ain't me. But I do have mad respect for the dude.
I'm a big Jeremy Lin fan. I live here in Houston, so we had Linsanity here for a little bit as well. So.
Hey, nothing wrong with that, man. Nothing wrong with Linsanity with his cornrows and everything, and he's got it all going on. I always loved movies. I mean, that's my earliest memory with my pop and like my brothers and just my family. We would watch just movies together all the time, and I never thought I would be in the movie industry. I thought if anything. I would become an NBA player and, you know, make a movie like Shazam. I was like, if Shaquille O'Neal can do it, then maybe I can get a movie career out of my basketball career. That was, I thought, the only way I would be into it. But I guess, you know, when I look back, I guess I was more into it than I realized, because anytime we had a video project for class, even my friends would tell me now that I grew up with, they were like, you were just a natural in terms of just, you know, putting things together. And I never thought about it then. I just wanted to pass the class so I wouldn't fail and so I could play basketball and play sports. Right. I thought of it that way. So
eligibility, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank God for Geology 101, rocks for jocks. Otherwise, I don't know what I would have done. But I wish I were kidding, but that's 100% true. No, man, I mean, I guess I'm trying to answer this question, and I know I'm going in a very roundabout way because I'm a little all over the place, but my dream was to be a pro athlete, and I did play in college. I played college football. I wasn't recruited as a basketball player because, you know, a 6'2 point guard, unfortunately, is kind of a dime a dozen. Mm-hmm. With the big schools. If I were 6'5", scouts would tell me, if you were 6'5", without a doubt, you'd have a full ride and probably a shot at the NBA. That's what I was told. Whether that's true or not, we'll never know, but it was a nice compliment to get. And so I played college football. I got injured, and that was the end of just my athletic career. And to make a very long story long, because it's not going to be very short, I graduated college 2007 from University of Illinois. Go Illini. For any alumni.
I have some good friends who went to the University of Illinois.
Actually. Hey, that's a good school right there, man. That's a good school right there. I have a lot of love for University of Illinois Champaign, man. That's some great memories there for sure, without a doubt. So I graduated, and I was also going through a pretty bad breakup with this girl that I thought I was going to marry and, you know, start my life in terms. I was going to be an accountant. I was going to go to law school. That was my plan. Mm-hmm. Coming out of college, and when the whole breakup happened, as anyone out there knows, when you have a bad breakup, that messes you up. I mean, it doesn't sound silly to say it, but it's like when you're in it, you guys know. When that happens, it just, you start reevaluating everything mm-hmm. that you're doing up to that point. So I deferred my law school acceptance. I turned down the job offer at the accounting firm. It was one of the big four accounting firms. They were offering a very nice contract, but I turned it all down, and I said, I want to take a year off and do something. I just want to do things for me, because my entire life was school and practice, and that was about it. I didn't have much of a social life growing up, and I didn't really have time to do leisurely things. And so I started just for fun. I took acting classes. I went to Second City Chicago, little plug for them there, and also the Piven Theater. Joyce and Byrne Piven, Jeremy Piven's parents, were running it. And Joyce Piven was one of my first acting coaches back in Chicago. And I just really loved it. There's just something about it. And I'm like, I felt like it was kind of a funny moment. I was like, well, why wasn't I doing this before? You know, sort of thing. I was just having so much fun. And Joyce actually encouraged me to just really give it a shot. She's like, I know you, when you came in, you were very honest with me. And he told me, you're kind of just doing this just to do it. But it's like, I really feel like you could make something out of yourself with this. And so I thought to myself, you know what? You only live once, and I'm going to move to LA and I'm going to see how it goes. So I went on Craigslist and I found an apartment in downtown LA, and I paid my deposit. I paid everything sight unseen, which is probably one of the dumbest things I could have done.
Okay.
Sight unseen, I went based off of the photos on Craigslist. And now, now to people out there, do not, I mean, and luckily in my case, it worked out. But I've been hearing horror stories now that on Craigslist, people will post these photos of a quote-unquote apartment, and they get there and it's nothing like it. Luckily, that wasn't the case for me. Mm-hmm. So I basically FedEx, you know, cashier's checks to this apartment complex and said, I'm ready to move in this day. It was August 2008 when I did that. And I bought a one-way ticket from Chicago to LA, and I basically shipped my stuff out. I was basically that ship with a P, everybody. I did not drop it. I did not say a bad word. I Federal Express boxes of my stuff to the apartment complex. They were very gracious in letting me just kind of hold it there until I got there. And I took the one-way ticket, booked it out to LA, and moved in. And luckily the place, you know, was the place in the photos. It was this really small studio apartment, man, in downtown Los Angeles. So it was like off of Garland Avenue. Like, it's like, oh man, it didn't even have a kitchen. Like, it didn't have a stove. It had a mini fridge. So I was lucky to have it came fully furnished. It came with like cable, but it was more of a motel. I don't know if I call it a hotel. This was definitely a glorified motel. Like, you know, like, you ever seen the movie Big?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know that hotel he stays at, the St. James Motel? I mean, it wasn't quite that level. It was a little couple steps above that. I mean, I at least had my own bathroom. I didn't have to go in the hallway and use the community bathroom. But it was you know, very humble beginnings, man. And I wouldn't trade it for anything, because I look back at that place, I'm like, wow, I lived in the... I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
That's awesome, man. Like, the whole... That's the classic, you know, pack up your bags and follow your dreams and go out west. And I'm glad it's really... You know, really worked out for you, man. That's awesome.
Oh, I did, man. My IMDb profile, that is 100% true, that I bought the one-way ticket out to Los Angeles. I know people, like, they like to say that because it sounds cool. Because it does. I mean, let's face it. It sounds cool to say, hey, I bought a one-way ticket because I'm going to pursue my dream. You got to be like, whoa, dude, that's pretty awesome. But I feel like that sounds cool, but I actually did it. So, you know, just letting y'all know.
So once you're out there, what was like, how did you really first break into the industry? I know you have some early credits, and you're talking about 2007, 2008, you have some credits there, but like, how did you really get your first gig, so to speak?
So this is something that I want to touch on for any aspiring actors, filmmakers out there who are doing work outside of Los Angeles and then becoming an LA transplant. So in Chicago, I actually booked work. My first professional gig was, I was a background actor on The Dark Knight. That was my first professional gig, which is pretty cool. And I got like really small co-star roles on the Leverage pilot shot in Chicago. I got like a co-star role on there. Like, I had one line. It got cut anyway, but I had one line. I got my SAG eligibility.
Yes.
And CSI New York. I mean, I booked a good amount of work in Chicago. And that also gave me the confidence to move out to Los Angeles and do my thing. But a lot of times, unless you're someone in New York and you're saying like you're the star of Hamilton or something huge and come to LA, they're not really going to care if you were, you know, student number one on CSI New York, because that it just didn't apply there. And I didn't know that. Nobody told me this. Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that, hey, I have credits, I have SAG eligibility, I've done this. You know, I was on, you know, two network shows. I should be good to go. And
there's probably like 100,000 other people that were student number one on all these other shows, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 1,000%. And if it's just, if you're not doing it in Los Angeles, it's almost like it doesn't count. It's almost like I was in like the D league, or I was in the minor leagues. And, you know, you could throw 20 no hitters in, say, like AAA baseball. But if you come up to the majors, that's not going to mean anything. You know, right. So that didn't really carry over. Nobody told me that. I learned that on my own, but that's fine. You know, I'm glad I did. So just FYI for people out there, that is a lot of times the case. So don't get discouraged when you try to go out for LA castings and you feel like you have a good, you know, deal of experience under your belt. It's just, if it hasn't been done in Los Angeles with these companies here, with the casting directors here, it's not that it doesn't matter. It's just like you kind of do have to start over in a sense. So some advice I'd love to give to anyone out there listening that's looking to get into the business, because I wish someone had told me that. But now I can tell everyone else that.
No, that's great, man. It's all about paying it forward and passing it down. You know, it's crazy in this, you know, this internet age that we have. Everybody's so connected, and you can tweet at people, and you feel so like, oh, I'm friends with so-and-so on Facebook or Twitter, right? It's like everybody, you know, it's not as special anymore. Everybody has a website, right? Everybody has a reel, you know, it's like, but I have a podcast, right? It's like, who does this, you know?
That's a great point too, because when I moved out here, there was MySpace. You know, MySpace was a thing. So for anyone, the youngins, you don't know MySpace is, do a Google search on it for a good laugh. I think my MySpace page still exists technically. I don't think I ever deactivated it. Hopefully, I think it's going to be embarrassingly hilarious if it's still up, because
right.
For those who don't know, MySpace was it was kind of like Tumblr with Facebook. It was a whole mishmash of social media stuff, and you could customize your own music to it, and it was like very image based.
That was painful, man. When people customize their backgrounds, you have like
I was that guy though.
Oh no,
that's how I hustled. So just to talk about how I broke in, that's how I hustled a lot of times, because I would post these photos of me quote working. Like as soon as they go to the MySpace page, like they would see like, oh, this guy's like, look at his headshots, they look pretty good.
Yeah,
I don't think it ever worked, but that was my mindset. I'm like, you know, my MySpace page is gonna look dope. and somebody's going to hire me. I don't think I ever got hired alphabetically from my MySpace. But yeah, I mean, the social media, you know, I owe a lot of my career to social media, to be perfectly honest, because I know we want to talk about this later, but we might as well bring it up now. So my short film, Police Guys,
yeah.
You and I have talked about it a little bit. So I made this thing for like $200. That was spent on stock footage, stock music, and food for the cast. Everyone else came out on favors. It was just one of these things where I had this idea. I was like, let's just make this buddy cop thing. I think this would be a lot of fun to make. And I wanted to showcase myself as a director. So the reason I was doing that is because I was going out on a lot of castings and not getting a lot of love for it. And it was coming to the point where access to high-end equipment was a lot easier, more accessible. So I knew I had access to high-end cameras, high-end lenses, and a very, very capable crew and very established cast. So I made this short film, and I really did it just as a vehicle for myself that I could put myself out there as a film director and someone who could do things. But we put out, like, we made a trailer for it just to see, just because we wanted to make a trailer. So it would just look funny. And we put it on Twitter, and this is back in, like, 2012. It was like around Thanksgiving 2012. And I remember within an hour or two, we had maybe like 5,000 retweets.
Wow.
And I think in total, we've gotten over 10,000 retweets on that trailer on Twitter. And it changed everything. I went from 500 followers to like, I think, God, I woke up the next day and I think I had 6,000 overnight.
That is impressive, man.
Yeah, and all because it was just people kept retweeting by copying and pasting. This is kind of before BuzzFeed really became a thing, and BuzzFeed was very much, you know, kind of they really mastered the copying and pasting and like making things viral and stuff like that. But this was just pure user base, and then I was starting to look at who was responding to it, and one of them was Edward Burns, the film director. And I remember he reached out to me and said, hey, I caught this trailer. It's like, I don't know if it's a feature or a short, but this is really cool. And I told him, I knew, you realize Brothers McMullen is one of my biggest inspirations to make my own movies. And this means everything. He's like, well, that's really cool, man. Like, hopefully we work together someday. And I'm like, whoa, what is going on? And I was like, cause this is still pretty early in my career. And that was an awakening for me, just, you know, where I realized social media is a game changer. This can influence, you know, the rise or the fall of a movie, I feel like. And so I kept capitalizing on that. That's what I started doing. I started kind of getting in producer mode and thinking, well, I'm going to start really promoting my Twitter page and get building that up. And it's at the point where I have a pretty substantial Twitter following, and I owe my career to this short film and social media, man. I mean, I get taken seriously in the rooms now because of that short film, because of social media.
Well, you got a blue check by your name, man. You made it.
You know what? I felt like my buddy, name job, Mike Mendez, he's this really great director. And he's done a lot of really cool horror films. He's got a movie coming out later this year with Dolph Lundgren, and who doesn't love Ivan Drago. But
right.
he got his verified check mark, which I don't know how I got mine before he did, but whatever, it is what it is. But
well, I remember when you first followed me on Twitter, I was like, oh man, this guy's a blue check mark.
I love that, man. It does make you feel a little good. Like the water tastes a little better, you know, and everything. It's just I kind of expected a fruit basket to arrive at my door and be like, you made it. But none of that happened. But Mike posted something the other day because he got his blue. It's, well, technically it's a blue badge. When I looked closely, like, it's actually a white check mark with a blue badge around it. I've been living a lie, you know. But Mike posted something like, I'm verified. Now I know how Pinocchio felt when he became a real boy. I was like, that's pretty spot on. It does feel pretty good. You feel very validated.
Well, yeah, let's talk about Police Guys for a second. So, yeah, first of all, two days, $200, man. Very impressive. Obviously, you're calling in favors from, you know, friends in the industry, and that's huge, obviously. But, I mean, as you know, I've referenced you on the podcast, and you guys might have picked up on, I work in the production industry as well. And just knowing those figures, I'm like, that is incredible, man.
So, yeah, slightly insane, too, because this was during daylight savings, too. So, when we didn't have lights, we didn't have we had exterior lights. We had some bounce cars and everything to really, you know, so there's no shadows and we had a little bit of fill, but we didn't have, you know, lights. We just didn't have the budget for that. So, and once the sun went down, we were screwed. Mm-hmm. So we had to start at about 6 a.m. and the sun was going down at that time by 5 o'clock. So we didn't even get a full 12-hour day. And I was still given our lunch breaks because I wanted to respect the fact that people are out there on their time and
their favor. Gotta respect the crew, man.
You got to, man, because if they would have walked, then what am I going to do? I mean, I can't really do it myself. So, I mean, you just can't. So, yeah, man, 2 days, $200. And we did, like, the editing, color correction, and the VFX ourselves. I had a lot of great help, man, on that. It's just the actors and crew were just top-notch.
Yeah, no, it is on YouTube, so I recommend everybody go check it out. It's called Police Guys. It's about, 15 minutes, I think it was?
It's 15 minutes, so it's, like, it's... It's a wonder. I was talking to my DP, Austin Nordell. Shout out to Austin Nordell, one of the best freaking DPs in the business that, you know, you guys will all know his name in good time. But he's been my DP for about 7 years now. I would say seven years, ever since I did my first little short film called, I did this thing called Codename. It was this web series. That was the first thing I directed. But the first thing I put out there was this short film called Drunk Dial. Where it's basically like that scene in Swingers where I keep calling this girl and she's not picking up and I'm leaving these messages because she was supposed to meet me. It was just something for me to do. You know, it's kind of like the guinea pig in terms of my, you know, directing myself in something.
Right.
And so Austin's been with me since then. And we were talking, I think maybe a month ago, we're like, how did we pull that off? You know, we're trying because we're about to do a couple awesome things together this year on a grander scale, but we're just like, how did we pull off Police Guys? Like we're trying to like we shouldn't have been able to do that, and we're really stealing shots the second day because for whatever reason we weren't allowed to shoot at the location on the second day, but we did it anyway. And sorry, not sorry, hashtag. We were looking over our shoulder the whole second day because we were sure someone was gonna throw us out, but we got it done somehow, man. And you got to get really creative with a lot of things. I mean, even so, you know that scene where I catch the bullet and I throw it back at the dude?
Yeah.
So that's my first AD, Evan Robichaud. I ran out of stunt dudes. And I was like, well, I can't just be shooting at nobody. I mean, we can't just pretend like it's the Invisible Man because that's going to be a VFX shot. We don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, hey, Evan, you want to do some stunts? And Evan's just the ultimate team player, man. He's just like, yeah, man, I'll get there. And I put him on this little ledge where he had to shuffle back and forth. And I was like, yeah, if he would have known what he had to actually do, he probably wouldn't have done it.
It is a very fun movie. It has a pretty twisted sense of humor, and it's just all over the place as far as what you guys encounter in that alleyway. And it's just a lot of fun. If you guys definitely make the 15 minutes to spare, check out Police Guys. You'll get a few laughs for sure. It's worth your time.
I appreciate it, man. Yeah, I mean, that's really where it all began for me. And I also realized that this is the direction I want to go with my career. I really started just focusing more on my writing and directing. You know, and this is, I had just wrapped Star Trek Into Darkness too when I would, no, I was in the process, I was still shooting. No, I had wrapped Star Trek Into Darkness, sorry, I'm just thinking out loud. Mm-hmm. And by the time I shot this, I was very much in love with Lens Flares because of J.J. Abrams.
There you go, the legacy continues.
Oh, it did. I mean, I didn't have the luxury of anamorphic lenses and nuclear powered flashlights like he did, but, We had what was called aspiring filmmakers out there. It's called a streak filter. So if you have an MB20, if you have like a matte box around your lens and you get what's called a streak filter and you get sunlight, if you kind of point it in the direction of the sun, it'll give that kind of a lens flare look. And that's basically how we made that happen. So any chance I got, and there's one in there when we get out of the car and we're putting the bulletproof vest on. If you notice when we walk out, like when I start walk out of frame, there's a little bit of a flare. And that was like my JJ nod right there.
No, I'll geek out for a second here. I'm just curious, what kind of cameras did you guys use on that? Do you remember?
So we were on those 5D Mark IIs.
Yes, that's what I used back in the day. I use 5D Mark IIIs right now, as well as Sony A7Ss. So I was wondering if you did some DSLR stuff on that.
We did. We had some really nice Zeiss Prime lenses on there. But so you say cameras. We had camera. There was one. I wish we had. We tried to make it look like we had three, which I think we.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, you wouldn't know if you didn't know, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, we had one camera.
That's awesome. I thought it might have been a DSLR, and yeah, it's all about the glass you put on it, man.
It's true. We were very fortunate with that, and I have some of my buddies that who are like my producing partners, Blacklist Digital, they hooked me up with these lenses and these filters because they just wanted to help me out because they saw that I really wanted to do this. And another shameless plug there, Blacklist Digital. They're just awesome guys over there. They're like, whatever you need, we got you. And they really helped me out with that. I mean, it's that was just a culmination of just labor of love, man. That was such a fun time.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you went on. Was this before or after you started your production company? Because you have a production company, Iron Will Productions. So was this all kind of tied together with it, or how did that come about?
It was all tied together with that, because I think technically the first time I had like a title card for Iron Will Productions was the short film Drunk Dial, which is also on YouTube. If you want to see me cussing out on the phone a lot, it's actually hilariously bad, but check it out. I mean, it looks great because I have a really good DP, but it's just something funny. But yeah, I mean, that was all tied into that to just, have just some credits to my production company. And it's just built up ever since then. So that's Iron Will, man.
Awesome. So, you know, let's talk some Shrek now, Johnny. You mentioned Into Darkness. So obviously, you know, that's the whole Star Trek connection. That's why you're here. So tell us about just how you got into Star Trek Into Darkness. Like, what was the whole process there, man?
Okay, so I went out on this like casting call at this audition for, it was just called Untitled Sci-Fi Movie, and there was no details being given.
not even Blue Harvest or anything cool like that. Untitled Sci-Fi Movie.
We weren't there yet. I got the dummy title by the time I knew I had the job and I was in my wardrobe fitting. But okay. We'll get so no. What it was I went to this like audition, and I kind of just had these general like lines to read that they weren't even from the movie. It's just like, just kind of had to say these words. They took my photo, clicked my video, and that was it. And I had no idea what it was. I just knew that it was a SAG project. So I was like, okay, it's SAG project, cool. That's union, yay, that's great. And that was, I wouldn't say, November 2011. And then I got an email in like December while I was shooting this other movie. It was this indie movie called Pawn, which is out on, I think it's somewhere, it's on Redbox or something. It's kind of a cop movie. I somehow find a way of playing a police officer all the time. It's kind of funny. I guess I did get typecast now that I think about it. But I got this email that I've been booked on this sci-fi movie, and I still at this point did not know what it was. I was like, okay, great. And they said, you need to be available basically January through May. I said, this is amazing. Okay, this is it. And so I finally, I get an email when I got back, from like the winter break. I still call it winter break because that's just an old school habit.
Same here.
And, and I got an email saying, you have a wardrobe fitting on this day on the Sony lot. I said, oh, okay. I was like, I knew it was a studio film, but I still at this point don't know what it is. And I get there, and I had to fill out this NDA that had to be at least 20 pages. Initialing and urine sample. No, I'm kidding. But, I mean, they might as well have taken a urine and blood sample, honestly, because
I retina scan.
So I fill out this NDA, and then finally they walk me back into the wardrobe, and I'm waiting in this room, and they bring in this stuff in like a covered garment bag. And
it just keeps building up.
I was like, what is happening here? I'm like, did I sign on for like one of those like adult film sci-fi spoofs? You know, like I'm wondering what's going on.
Right.
And I open up the garment bag and I see this like red tunic, like this top. I'm like, wait, this looks really familiar. Like, so I try it all on. I try on all the wardrobe. Everything fits great. And I look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, holy bleep. And I turned to the wardrobe supervisor. I said, is this Star Trek that I'm working on? And she's like, yeah, you didn't know that? I was like, well, so that's a yes. That's what I said. It's like, so yes? She's like, yeah. I was like, oh, wait. And so I had to take a moment. I was like one of those dudes that, you know, in those David Blaine videos when they're responding to the street magic. I kind of had to walk away about 30 feet and, like, just process it. And then I was like, oh my God, I'm going to start. You know, this is amazing. And I'm going to work with J.J. Abrams is one of my favorite directors. So I'm like, I'm going to work with J.J. Abrams. This is amazing. And at that point, they said, okay, now that you know what you're on, you only refer to this as Project HH. That's what it was known as, with HH meaning hush, hush.
Okay.
So I, even on the slates, on the call sheets, everything said Project HH. And if you look closely on any of the behind-the-scenes footage of Star Trek Into Darkness, whenever you see the slate in the frame, it'll say
Project HH. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So just an FYI out there to anybody who's wondering if you caught that, that was our code name on set, was Project HH, so that if one of the call sheets was, like, you know, left laying around on the studio lot, which happens, mm-hmm. People wouldn't know. We all had code names. On the call sheet, the Enterprise was known as the Chrysler Building, nice. Stuff like that. And, like, everyone, Chris Pine, John Cho, Carl Urban, Zoe Saldana, everyone had code names. Like, so you might have been able to put two and two together, but chances are you probably wouldn't. JJ was very discreet. You know, right. Very good about being discreet. And it made so much sense to me at that point when I realized what I was working on, because I was like, oh, now the secrecy makes a lot of sense, because I was going to think I'm working for a crazy person, and, you know, and I was like, no, I'm just working with J.J. Abrams, who's just great at keeping secrets.
No, I remember, obviously, it shot in L.A., so there was a lot of secrecy, and they were very upset when there was some set photos leaked. It was like Cumberbatch and Quinto fighting. It was like the climax of the movie. Yeah.
I wasn't on set that day. So that was done. So I shot only on the Sony lot, mm-hmm. Stage 15. And funny enough, I had a meeting on the Sony lot last week and I had to stop by Stage 15 just because soaking all the memories. So
right. All
of my footage was shot on Stage 15 where the Enterprise interiors were, except for, so they were shooting at Playa del Vista Studios that day, doing that epic battle between Spock and Khan. Mm-hmm. And it was just a rehearsal. But, yeah, I wasn't there that day. If I was, I'd like to think that I would have stopped the leak. But, I mean, unfortunately, yeah. I wasn't.
You would have stopped it.
Yeah, but I wasn't me. Just FYI, Bill. It wasn't me.
So you weren't there. Very interesting. You weren't on set that day of the leak, John.
very convenient, right? No, I was. So that was down when they shot that Playa del Vista. They were doing some of those exterior shots. Some of the green screen shots were down there, but
right.
I was solely on the Sony lot, which was great. A lot of fond memories on that set, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very impressive set, the Enterprise set. I mean, was it like all encompassing when you, like, got on it, like, look around, you really felt like you were on the ship itself?
Yeah, man. Yeah, 1000%. Because what it was they built the sets to be interconnecting, so you could actually walk from medical to mid bay, or you can walk from there to the bridge. Everything was all connected. It wasn't separate sets. You could literally, so if they wanted to do a steady shot and walk it through, they could walk from one set to the other as if it was a real ship. It was a really surreal thing, because I was just one day during the lunch break, I was just walking around and I realized I was walking through the, I just, you have that moment where you forget where you are, and I'm like, I'm walking through the U.S. Enterprise. Because it was just so cool how they did that, and that's a kudos to J.J. Abrams, because J.J. wanted to make it feel like you were in space and on the spaceship when it was happening. So it was a really cool thing to see. Yeah.
Right, and so you were one of the security guards. You escort Khan in when he gets arrested.
Good old Benedict Cumberbatch, the guy with the deepest voice ever, and can make anything sound evil. Basically, Benedict was just one of those. He's one of those very special actors, and I mean that. What I mean by that is, there's certain actors that if you are around them or anyone who has that kind of presence, you want to elevate your game. And he's one of those actors. It's really hard to describe unless you're around it. But, you know, I would imagine it'd be the same thing if you're on set with Leonardo DiCaprio or Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep. It's just, they have this aura about him, and he's got that aura where you're like, oh, I better be on my A game. And he's so unassuming. It's not like he insists upon himself. It's just, he just has that. And it was just really fascinating to see that. So I got this story on set. So there's a scene where Kirk is talking to Khan about, you know, the Dreadnought class spaceship, Marcus's spaceship that basically attacked him. And that, at this point, the Enterprise is in red alert, so the red lights are blaring. And we do the first take, and I'm standing on my mark, but the red light is just right in my face, like blindingly in my face. And I'm not going to complain, because I'm thinking to myself, if this is making the shot look good, I'm not going to say anything. I'll just kind of like look away and not look directly at it, like in a solar eclipse or whatever. And JJ yells cut, and he's like, "Hey, can we get a flag on that red light? It's blaring on John just way too much. You know, let's just." And I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, thank God." And I said, "Oh, thanks, JJ." He's like, "Yeah, no problem." I was like, "No, JJ, that was like the red sun of Krypton right in my face." And so, and he looks at me, gives me this look, and he's like, "Krypton." And like I don't know why this stuck with him so much, but he's like Krypton, like he kept repeating Krypton, and then he walked by me, he looks at me, he goes, shakes his head, says Krypton. I was like, brother, I read that leaked script to Superman Flyby, so I'm fully on board if you're trying to cross that over with this movie. And he's like, no, and it's like, how do you know about that? Wait, this is my best JJ, but how do you know that? What are you talking? No. I was like, hey, I'd buy that for a dollar. I was like, that's a RoboCop
reference. RoboCop reference.
And he's like, I don't even know what to say. And then the whole day, the rest of the day, we come back from lunch, and he looks at me, just goes, Krypton. Like, if I ever, you know, I bumped into JJ really randomly at like Barnes & Noble at the Grove, and I said, hey, I was sent to say hi to him, and I never assumed that they remember me because this guy's meet so many people. So I went up to him, I said, hey, and I was like, hey, JJ. He's like, hey. He was like, John, right? I was like, yeah. I was like, you know, remember Krypton? He's like, oh my God, I forgot about that. Krypton. It's like, and like he still had, I was like, you still haven't let it go. He's like, no. I was like, so that's always good. I always have that kind of like an inside joke with JJ Abrams, which is kind of funny to me because I could just go up to say Krypton and it'll immediately spark that moment on set. Yeah, he's just every time you pass me, like, Krypton. And it went on, not just that day. Every time we saw each other, he's just Krypton. He would like drop at least one Krypton, and most of the time he was whispering it, which was kind of funny to me. It's like, you know, it's like you're like the Jewish Barry White going on right now with that whispering going on.
Yeah, man. I, you know, speaking of J.J. Abrams' Krypton or Superman Flyby, I would have loved to see that Superman movie. Especially, you know, I know Superman Returns, Man of Steel, there's both mixed opinions about it both. Obviously, I'm a Superman guy, as you know, so.
You know, you're talking to we're speaking the same language, man. And I want to say this about Superman Returns. I very much enjoy Superman Returns. I think what the problem was with that was it played like a love letter to Richard Donner. Which I'm totally cool with because I grew up with the Richard Donner Superman. So The fact that he did the same title sequence, the John Williams music.
Oh, that was incredible.
Know,
yeah.
You know, the way that the titles flew into the screen, just like in 78.
Mm-hmm. 78.
I love that, but that didn't translate to the newer audience because if you hadn't seen the Richard Donner Superman, you're not going to get the jokes. I mean, even when he's talking with, Kitty Kowalski, and he's saying, Lex Luthor saying, do you know what my dad said to me when I was younger? She said, you know, get out. He's like, no, before that. And like, that was a literal, that took that directly from the first Superman. And I'm sitting there laughing my ass off and keeping around like, well, what's so funny? And I was like, oh, that was the first Superman movie. Okay.
Well, statistically speaking, it's still the safest way to travel, right?
Yes, exactly. Stuff like that, man. And so I love that, but I felt like, you know, and I loved that was Bryan Singer's intentions because I could tell he very much loves the Richard Donner Superman. Mm-hmm. And that's always going to be my favorite. I do love the George Reeves version too, because I felt like that was probably my favorite interpretation of Clark Kent because he wasn't bumbling. He was just,
right, you know, he's kind just of a cool guy. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a cool, smooth. And that, I thought Lois and Clark touched on that pretty well too. They acknowledged like, oh, it's kind of just a cool dude. But somehow we can't tell he's Superman because he has glasses, because that's totally logical. But there's also an explanation to that, fanboys and fangirls.
Yeah, there's an explanation for everything when it comes to comic books. But yeah, you're totally right about Superman Returns. It was a vague sequel to movies that had come out 30 years before, and that was just not what we needed at the time. I feel like we needed a Batman Begins for Superman, and that's what Flyby would have been. And yes, the earlier drafts had like a Kryptonian Lex Luthor and all that, and that was odd. But I think as they got more and more drafts, they kind of even ironed things out, and it would have been pretty exciting. So maybe the DC Extended Universe is lots of rumors flying about that right now. Maybe they'll have to restart again, and we can get J.J. Abrams on the case. So we'll see.
You know what I would love to see in the DC Extended Universe, and name draw, Jeff Johns is actually a buddy of mine, and Jeff's a guy that I admire very much. I know you do, because when he came on to Smallville, what a game changer was.
All his episodes are my favorite. Jeff Johns is my favorite comic writer.
He's the best. I mean, between him and like Jim Lee, you know, and then I throw Frank Miller in there too, because I love, you know, The Dark Knight Returns. I love that. I just love that story so much. With Jeff, you know, so Jeff told me a great story. This is a story that I can share with you. It has to do with Smallville, but I figure while I'm here, I'll share with you since we're on this.
You know, did you know that I have a podcast about Smallville?
Oh, you know what? Well, why don't we save that story for the Smallville podcast? How about that? So listeners, you're going to have to tune in to this Always Told on the Smallville if you want to hear the story that I got from Jeff Johns regarding some Smallville. It's a goodie. So I'll leave that one for another time. How about that?
To be continued on that.
To be continued for sure. But I will say, this is what I would love to see in the DC Extended Universe, because, you know, my favorite show on TV is actually The Flash. This includes Game of Thrones, Westworld, you know, all those shows. It's my favorite show on TV. Even if it wasn't Barry Allen, I would still be very much invested in these characters, because they've done such a great job with that show. And what I would love to see happen is, you know, basically the equivalent of the Infinite Crisis. And that way, it's like rebooting, but not rebooting, because basically, you know, we can have a pre-crisis extended universe and a post-crisis extended universe. So that way, if we want to bridge that gap, and then we can maybe make Grant Gustin the cinematic Flash and start, you know, cleaning up all this stuff, it would be forgiven, because then we can bring those worlds together.
Right. It's such a smart thing to do, much like Days of Future Past and X-Men kind of reset everything and fixed it. It would have been the same thing for DC Universe. I really hope they do that, John.
Exactly, and also the red matter in J.J. from Star Trek. I know a lot of Trekkies didn't like that, but I thought, and his for him, that was brilliant, because that was his way of just, this is, you know, not the prime Earth.
Yeah, it's so smart. It's the J.J. universe, the Kelvin timeline, as we've come to know it, right? It's a reboot, but it's a sequel, and it's a prequel all in one. I mean, that's genius. That's a whole genius part about the Kelvin timeline films, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and I 1,000% agree with that. So, see, listeners, I was going to tie it all into Star Trek.
it was coming back, guys.
It was coming back. I brought it back. But that's what I would love to see in this extended universe. And I feel like it's such a name drop. My other buddy is Jonathan Scheck. He plays Jonah Hex on the CWDC shows on Legends of Tomorrow. And I remember talking to him about it. I'm like, you know, if you get in a room with those guys, like, tell them, like, Jonah Hex was there, for, like, pre-crisis. Like, he could be the link between the cinematic universe, you know, because the dude's been through it all. I just think that'd be a really cool thing to do. And I think Grant Gustin's doing such a – that whole cast is so on point.
Oh, The Flash, you know, beyond just the superhero stuff, it gets you in the feels every week with, like, the whole Allen family, and just, oh, so good.
Yeah, and that's my test for what a great genre movie, because if you watch The Dark Knight, which is probably one of the better movies that have come out in our, you know, in our time, but if that wasn't Batman, if he was just a vigilante, if he was, you know, just a general vigilante, you would still be just as invested in that movie. And that the Joker was just a sociopath, kind of psycho sociopath.
Yeah, and it had no ties to any pop culture that already existed. It would still be great.
You would still be great. It might have won Best Picture, honestly. I feel like it wasn't nominated because it was a Batman movie. It was a DC movie.
Right.
You know, and that's my whole thing. If you take away that element in a superhero movie, in a sci-fi movie, are you still invested in the story? And the answer is yes, then they've made a great movie. I mean, you know, that's usually my barometer of success. And that's the way I go about it. And I felt like Star Trek did that.
I feel exactly the same way, because in Star Trek 09, the opening scene is my favorite scene in all of Star Trek, because it just gets you on every level, and you don't know who these characters are. It doesn't matter, but it just gets you so much when, you know, George Kirk has to sacrifice himself to save the ship and save the family, and it's such a strong way to kick off the movie and this whole franchise.
Yeah, and well, it's okay. And George, you know, for anyone who's sad about George Kirk, don't worry. He was saved by, you know, Odin of Asgard, and he became Thor. So obviously, things worked out fine for George Kirk. He turned out okay.
And rumor has it he'll be back in Star Trek 4, but we'll see about that. But
that's what I've been hearing, you know, and that's what I've been hearing. I would love to see that happen. I would love to see that come about. It almost be like generations for the new audience, you know.
But better.
Yeah, Oh yeah.
So taking it back to Into Darkness. So yeah. On your time on set, did you interact with, like, obviously you talked to Abrams, but in any of the other actors in any serious capacity, or did you just kind of stay in your lane? I know how it is when you're in these bigger productions, how you just kind of do your job. You don't want to overstep your bounds or anything like that. So did you have any kind of interactions with anybody else while you were there?
I did later on. Later on. At first I was very, very, you know, just, you know, you had those moments like I didn't feel like I belonged there. Because these are people that I've watched. I had watched the 09 Star Trek and was a huge fan of it. And so it was just surreal to see like Simon Pegg sitting two chairs down from me when we're in you know, casting holding, you know, getting ready for the next setup. But so I was very kind of reserved, and then all of a sudden one day I'm sitting in my chair and I hear this voice go, "You're gonna die today because you were in a red shirt." And I look up and it's Simon Pegg. And I was like, "You're in a red shirt too, though." And he's like, "Oh, you're right. Oh, no. I'm going to have to ask for a refund." And then that was kind of like the icebreaker where when once Simon was like, kind of like, I don't know if he intentionally meant for it to be this, but for me, that was like a sign of, it's cool. We can all interact. Everyone was a little different. Chris Pine was very nice, but also very focused when we were on set. And even in rehearsal, he was just very dialed in to what he was doing. And I could always respect that. Carl Urban was very much the same way. He was just very focused on set. Zoe, super sweet. I got, you know, we all had a bonding moment on, so that scene where we are walking Khan through the engine room. So fun movie trivia for everybody. That's actually the Budweiser factory in Los Angeles. It's off of the 101 freeway. And the coldest day of my life, and I'm from Chicago, and I've grown up in winters. That was the coldest day of my life because we're in this like negative degree, you know, temperature. Just we're in a big brewery, and they dress it up to look like the engine room, which is really cool. And basically, we had this bonding experience where basically all of us cast members were like doing jumping jacks and push-ups in between takes because we were trying not to get frostbite. And I just remember. Benedict said something. He's like, "I wonder if I can get a beer here." Well, I'm, you know, like, so he's like, "JJ, is there a tap I can attach to one of these and we can maybe keep warm a different way?" You know, that was towards the end of my run in terms of my work on the movie. But yeah, so they it warmed up, you know, to that. But for the first like month or so, I was very much just trying to like not piss anybody off. You know, and not get fired.
That reminds me, have you seen the recent social media leak for the behind the scenes pictures of Discovery?
I haven't.
This guy posted, he took a picture and put it like on his Instagram or Facebook or something. He's like, "Hey, getting ready with my fellow Klingons today." And my first thought is, this guy is so fired.
We had a couple people like that on set. We had one that posted a photo from his wardrobe fitting. He was not brought to set, and he was a blue shirt. He had a chance, you know, to move on. He was working in the science division. He would have been fine, but, he couldn't leave well enough. We had a couple people who, I'm not going to use names, but this dude, I remember he parked in the crew parking lot. He was a background actor, mm-hmm. and he parked in the crew parking lot, by base camp. Which that's a big no-no. If you're ever on set, don't just park where they tell you to park. Don't do anything else. And he gets out of his car, and people are looking at this guy like, "Hey, are you crew?" He's like, "No, I'm security." I'm like, "Oh no, this guy's not gonna last till lunch." And he didn't. He was gone after lunch.
But, you know, it's you feel bad for him, but at the same time, you have to sign so many things that tell you not to do that. It's totally your own fault if you break the rules and get fired after something like that. You know.
Yeah, and it's not like it's not like that sign for crew parking was written in Klingon. It was very much in English. I'm pretty sure it was in Spanish too, in case he's bilingual. I mean, it was. I was like, dude, that's just the one thing. I mean, he probably would have parked in like J.J. Abrams or Roberto Orsi's or Kurt Alex's parking spot, and just been like, whatever. And I'm like, oh, man, like it was a very interesting guy. And one day I'll make a movie about him, like from the 6 hours I spent with him, because he was a character, and he was always like, I don't know if he was a former bodybuilder, but he was always like flexing, you know, and talking about his like his pythons or whatever. And I'm like, man, you sound like a You sound like a poor man's Hulk Hogan from the 80s. I don't know what's going on here.
Brother.
yeah, I was like, I called him brother, too. I'm like, brother, you sound like Hulk Hogan from the 80s. And he totally didn't get it. I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, that's good. So you were you're only in a small handful of scenes, but you shot a long time there.
Well, it was on and off. So it wasn't continuously for 5 months. So it was just based around the schedule of what they were shooting. So it just happened to be that it was within the span between January and May. 2012. Yeah, so I mean, in a handful, some stuff got cut, unfortunately, but that happens. That comes with the territory. It's because it's not about the red shirt, you know, and, you know, it's about, you know, that guy named, you know, James T. Kirk, you know, and he's kind of important to the story. But it was just a fun experience, and I learned a lot just because JJ was very gracious and just kind of letting me, you know, unofficially shadow him. On the set, and I just learned a lot about how he interacts with actors, because that's a tall order. One, to be taking on a franchise, and two, to be working with a lot of these, I don't want to say egos, but personalities of very established actors who know what they're doing. But it's just like to have control of that. And anytime an actor had a question for him, and there were a lot, and rightfully so, he always had an answer. And I was just very inspired by that. And I was like, there's a reason why this guy is where he is, because, you know, he does his homework. He's very much people oriented. He's there for the actors, and very performance driven as a director. So I have another thing. This is just an observation I made. We're doing this scene where it was between Kirk and Khan, and Benedict just nails the scene, and he nailed every take he did. He did have a couple bloopers, but who doesn't? But he just nailed this take. And then he's like, great, let's move on. And then I see Benedict go, JJ, can I ask you something? And I just see him kind of whispering and kind of pleading he was basically pleading his case to get another take. And then in the middle of it, JJ just kind of cuts him off. Like, dude, do you want another take? If you want one more, we do one more. Do you feel like you can do something different? He's like, and Benedict's like surprised. Like, oh, yeah, that'd be great. Like, all right. And he's like, wait, guys, hold on. We're going to do one more. And then that's the take they use in the movie, actually.
Because, wow.
Yeah. It's so I learned that if the actor really feels like they can bring something different, let them do it. And I never saw him really say no to any idea. His answer was always, try it. He's like, but if it doesn't work, then let's scrap it. And I love that about him. And I feel like, you know, I feel like Steven Spielberg is the same way because, you know, as we know, you know, him and Spielberg are very tight and have very, you know, kind of similar styles. And I really take that to heart as a director, because I know that when actors come to set, they're really investing time with this character. They're going to have ideas, and they say, what if I do this? My answer is the same thing. I say, try it. But I always give the caveat of, but if it's not working, you know, we're not going to, then let's move on from that. But if you shut them down, then they're going to be wondering, oh, what if I would have done that? It might've worked. So it's just like, you don't lose anything by letting them try or even doing one more take.
Yeah. Very healthy, collaborative, creative environment. It sounds like that's awesome, man.
Yeah. And like, that's why he's who he is. You know, that's why the really successful directors I've noticed are like that. One of my really good friends and kind of a mentor to me, named James Wan, who is about to direct Aquaman.
Mm.
And he's very much the same way. And he comes to set, he knows what he wants, but he's just, you know, he's not like a bull rush. He's the right balance of, you know, easygoing, but also stay strong in his convictions. Because I feel like if you got someone who tries to bull rush everything, then that's not the way to go. But if you're someone that's too passive, you're just going to get trampled. And to have that right balance of both, I've just noticed the really elite directors have that. And it's what I'm trying to get. That's, you know, that's what I aspire to have. So, I mean, that's what I took out of, you know, working with like JJ. It was just really magic to see, man.
That's awesome. And so, yeah, speaking of that, you know, you're kind of transitioning now more to behind the camera stuff, right? Like producer, director, more so than acting. It's like, so where are things go from here for you now?
I mean, that is my main focus. My main focus is the directing, writing, acting, producing. I also, you know, have a hand in post-production. So that's my main focus. I really love being behind camera. I love constructing a scene and putting it together, you know, framing compositions. I love all that stuff. And, you know, that's really a great thing for me, because even in sports, I loved coaching. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I even love coaching more than I played, and I love playing, don't get me wrong. But there's something gratifying to me about the directing and then the behind the scenes process. And then just, you know, really motivating the actor to the point where they really surrender to their character and bring out this performance that even they didn't know they had. And to me, that's exciting. And for some people, it's the opposite. They like to be in front of camera and they want to bring that out of themselves and, you know, and present that to people. I'm just the opposite of that, you know.
No, it's good to have that balance, though. Okay, because when you can do everything, you can kind of understand where everybody's coming from. Because I've found, like, you know, when you work at these things, when you know, you got producers on high or whatever, they have an idea and they really want something to happen a certain way. You're like, man, you don't even know what you're asking me to do.
Yeah, especially when they say fix it in post, and I work in post production. I'm like, oh no, like we ain't fix, like we're not magicians in post. So FYI, when you say fix it in post, like we can do a lot of cool things now. But don't abuse the system, and it happens a lot. They're like, well, you can just VFX that. Like, I mean, I've known productions that they'll have their camera B operator in the shot, in the camera A shot, but they don't move them out because they know they can rotoscope them out and just paint them out. And I'm like, that's lazy. You can just move. Yeah. You can just move like 2 feet to your right and he's not in the shot, or he or she, because there's plenty of awesome female camera operators that I've met. But it's just an abuse of the system, and it's just mind-boggling and kind of hilarious to me that it's like you're spending that much extra time in a VFX shot. And that's where the bulk of VFX is going now.
Yeah, it's like to fix easily avoidable errors.
Yeah, and I'm just a firm believer in VFX is the supplement. It's not the substitute. Like, to me, it's not. I'd rather, you know, if I can shoot as much of it in camera as possible, I will. But always have some sort of practical reference, you know, for the VFX artists. And the VFX artists are going to love you for that because it's just less time consuming and it just looks better on screen when you do that. You know, that's just, you know, you can, there's, that being said, there's a lot of cool things being done with VFX, and it's really fascinating. But at the same time, I don't like to rely on that. I like that to be, you know, the cherry on top of the sundae, not everything else, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, the best special effects, you don't even know are there. And it just seamlessly blend in with everything else that's going on. Absolutely.
That's 1,000% right. And you should coin that quote if someone else hasn't, because that's I wish I'd said it first. Now I'm going to have to reference you when I say it.
I think I might have heard it somewhere else, but I'll take credit, John.
And I'm going to give credit to you. So hashtag Zach. I mean, that's 1,000% right. You know.
Cool. Well, John, you know, before we sign off here, man, what do you got in the works right now that you can share with us that we should look forward to coming out from you in the near future?
Oh, I mean, a couple things. I mean, I've got a couple pilot scripts that are out there that are we're going to see if they're going to land and get a home. Can't really give specifics about either of them, but a couple things are out there. Hopefully they find a home soon. I have a movie I produced last year. It's going to come out in a couple months. It's called Savage Dog, and it has Scott Atkins from the Undisputed franchise is in there. He's also on Doctor Strange. Mm-hmm. So he's the star of the movie. And also Kung Lee, the former UFC fighter, is in there. And we've got Marco Zorro, who he fought with Scott in Undisputed. So it's a really cool action movie. It's directed by Jesse Johnson, who's a really good friend of mine. I've known him for about 6 or 7 years now. And so it takes place in like 1959 Indochina, and it's kind of like a throwback to those Man with No Name westerns, where the guy comes to town and he's just, you know, almost like those revenge tours. He just comes in and he's ready to just kick ass and take what belongs to him. And you don't see a lot of that. And so it's called Savage Dog. I mean, look out for it in the next, I would say, 2 or 3 months. I think it's going to be released. I'm not 1,000% sure. The distributor's still figuring things out, but so that was my producing venture. Looks like I may be jumping on as a producer on another project, and I'm doing this little kind of docudrama series called Fight or Flight. That's going to be addressing violence in the world and how you can keep yourself safe and become a hard target, like make your home a hard target. So it's kind of half educational, half reenactment sort of thing. So that's one of my passion projects, because I think it's important for people to know that they can keep themselves safe you know, from these situations. They don't have to be a victim. So that's that one. And I have a movie I'm directing later this year. It's all I'm gonna say is it's regarding the 1992 LA riots.
Okay.
So I know that there's a couple of movies out there. I know Daniel Craig has one called Kings. that's coming out. It's him and Halle Berry. I have one. It's about the 92 riots. That's all I'll say. I'm taking a page out of J.J. Abrams' book, and I'm probably even saying too much. That's not even a page out of J.J.'s book. He wouldn't even say the subject.
Thanks for giving us just a little peek into the mystery box there, John.
The mystery box. You saw that TED Talk too, didn't you? I know you're referencing. And then that's really right now. My main passion project is the riots movie. This one's kind of a personal one to me in a lot of ways, because for multiple reasons. But that's one to look out for. And I won't even say the title of it, even though you can probably find it on IMDb.
We'll keep an eye out for all that stuff. And thank you again, man, so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's so fascinating to hear these behind the scenes stories of how the industry works and all that great stuff. So, you know, if people want to, you know, just kind of keep following you and find you and your work online, like, where can they do that? Website, Twitter, that kind of thing.
Well, Twitter it's simple. It's just my name, John Lee Brody, which is no H in the John. So John Lee Brody, all one word. It's same thing on Instagram. I'm not on Tinder or eHarmony or any of those things, unfortunately. I mean, so you can't find me there, but I don't know if you'd want to anyway, but Twitter, Instagram. Twitter's probably where I'm most active. If you want to like engage and talk in nerdy conversations, I'm always game for that. You know, I mean, you and I follow each other on there, and we had a funny one the other week. Someone was talking about the Carrie Fisher episode of Smallville.
Yes, yes.
And I had to jump in. I'm like, hey, you know, they referenced Buffy in that episode, and James Marsters was a recurring guest star. He was Spike on Buffy, and then Project 1138.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I had to jump in and just, you know, was it my favorite episode? No, but it was hilarious to me. And I loved all the references. So mm-hmm. I can't hate on Smallville at all. And, you know, so that being said, always hold on to Smallville podcast. You know, that's going to be in our new future, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes. You will be. That is something else in your future coming up, John, for sure.
I'm excited about that. So everyone, please tune in to, I don't know how many times we've mentioned it, but I'm mentioning one more time. Always hold on to Smallville. You know, what's funny is, okay, before we go, I got to tell you, because no, you know what? I'll save that for the Smallville podcast, because that's more appropriate there.
Two cliffhangers now for the Smallville podcast.
Two, actually three. There's three things that I have related to Smallville. Things that'll really tie into that universe really well. So we're gonna leave it at that, and kind of pull the Tony Robbins and be like, oh, we're out of time. So you gotta tune into the other podcast. So.
Awesome, man. That's cool. And then, you know, if you ever pop back into the Star Trek universe, be sure to let us know.
I you know, they haven't called me back, so maybe I did die off screen. You never know. I mean, then I didn't get the call from Beyond or Discovery. But I thought Beyond was great. Honestly, I thought Beyond was a very much a throwback to the original series. And I thought that was a really cool thing. It felt like a, you know, hour and a half, hour 45 minute episode of the Star Trek series. I thought that was awesome.
Absolutely.
I thought it was so much fun. You know, Justin Lin's just killing it, you know, with everything he does. He's kind of like got the Midas touch with franchises. He's an inspiring one as well. But, as far as Discovery goes, we'll see. I have high hopes for it. It seems like they're on the right path, but, you know, we won't really know until we see it. So one day, maybe I'll find my way back in that universe. It may not be in front of camera. Maybe I'll be behind camera, or maybe you'll see me pop up in the DC universe somewhere.
That's right, man. So stay tuned. Pay attention to the credits, man. That's what I always tell people, you know, because I know in school, our professors always said, you know, you want to stay and watch the whole credits, because one day your name's going to be in there, and you're going to want to see it. And that's so true. And so that's why it's so great that, you know, Marvel has kind of encouraged everyone to stay to the end of the credits. Now, I feel like they're getting a little lazy now and putting in these mid-credit scenes, you know, so people can leave after that. Like, no, you got to stay for the whole thing, man.
That's why you got to do – they're being smart, though, because they put two. They do the mid and the end credit ones. So they keep it smart, so they keep you honest. But some of them, yeah, they only leave the mid-credits. Like, oh, we can leave.
What about the other 15,000 names there, man? Come on, show a little respect.
Yeah, especially to the VFX artists, because you guys don't know. Like, it's just, there's a lot of them that I call, like, the post-production, you know, personnel. It's like the offensive lineman on a football team. You're not going to, you know, really know who they are. They don't get the headlines, but they can't work without them.
Right.
You know. And, you know, editing, you know, I know we were supposed to end this podcast, but, you know, you got me going with this. You know, editing is, they say, like the last rewrite of the movie. This is where you can discover new things. You're not going to deviate completely, but you know, and it's people you don't realize. There's just, you know, you'll watch a Scorsese movie and be blown away by it, but you don't think about the fact that Thelma Schoonmaker really makes a lot of that movie because of the choices she makes as an editor and because Marty Scorsese trusts her, you know. And it's things like that you don't think about, but, you know, and then especially VFX artists, there's so many compositors and rotoscope artists, and, you know, that's why those credits are really long in those Marvel movies, because they got, I mean, they're going like, I don't want to say 300, 400, 500 deep with like these artists. Mm-hmm. And sometimes their assignment is just the rotoscope, you know, the hand on Iron Man. Right. So it's just, like, we don't think about that stuff. So, I mean, just FYI people, I know, you know, you want to, you know, get out of there, but at the same time, you can, I think you could spare a couple minutes to just, you know, at least acknowledge them. You might not know who they are, but it's a nice gesture. Yes, exactly.
If you don't stay for the post-credit scene, stay for the music, right? Over the end of credits. If you don't stay for the music, stay for the people who spent hours and hours and hours and days and days and days and weeks and weeks and weeks and months and months and months working on the entertainment you just enjoyed.
Exactly. And I will say, you know, with VFX, I mean, Tim Miller was a VFX guy, owns Blur Studios, became the Deadpool director. So just because they might be listed as a VFX artist doesn't mean, you know, they ain't going to be somebody.
Yeah, and the directors of the John Wick movies were the stunt coordinators on The Matrix, right? So
yeah, exactly, exactly. Never know. So you just never know, man. But either way, it's just, it takes, there's a lot of moving parts to make a successful feature film. Just to make a movie in general, there's a lot of moving parts, and it goes way beyond the people listed in the opening title credits and the people you see on screen. It's just, that's why I was having this conversation with somebody the other day about possessory credit, and if a director takes that, that's fine. I mean, I'm not saying don't take it. For me personally, I don't think I could ever do that, because having worked in pretty much every aspect of the motion picture business, and knowing what it takes to make a movie, I don't think I would feel comfortable seeing a film by John Lee Brody. It's just because it's the films by, you know, I may have directed it and pushed it in the right direction, but at the same time, it's a collaboration of all of us.
You don't do a John Carpenter thing where your name's over every title of the movie?
I don't think I could ever do that, man. I don't think I could, because I just, you know, I have so much love for everybody that works on the movie, you know, from everyone from you know, the financier, and, you know, all the way down to craft services. Like, it takes all those people to make these things happen. And to me personally, everyone, just FYI, if you want to take possessory credit, that's totally cool, and I'm not going to hate on you for it. But for me personally, I don't think I could ever do it, because I just view it so much as like a team effort.
Yeah, man, I've worked a lot in television myself, and I simultaneously get like way too much and not enough credit for what I do. Like,
yeah,
like, oh wow, you worked in the Super Bowl stuff, or I'm like, yeah, I was one cog in a very big machine. Yeah, very. And then other times it's like, oh yeah, what do you just run a camera? Big deal. I'm like, well. Can you run a camera? Like, you
know, little more complicated than that, but you know, and that's what we got to deal with, man. But you know, it's, we wouldn't trade it for anything. I know that.
Absolutely, man. I love it. So, all right, John. Well, thanks again for talking to me today. And you know, the life and times of John Lee Brody isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
My casting choices, okay, would be for Ruck, you got to go with Dave Bautista, right? He's Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy. He played Jinx in...
Inspector?
Yeah, was that Jinx? What's his name? Hinks, Mr.
Hinks. Mr. Hinks. Yeah, Mr. Hinks.
That's the wrong James Bond film, everybody.
The 602 Club.
Going back to the Gotham thing really quickly, I know this is semi-derailing. Why would you want to move to Gotham? I mean, he has to have been there. It's like the picture that he has on his wall is this beautiful, shining, like, daytime view, if I'm not mistaken, of Gotham, which I don't think we ever see. It was like, I'm not really sure. Charm City looks quite nice. Like,
so. Saturday Morning Trek.
It's very much like a continuation of the original series.
You know what? You raise a very good point, and it's one we probably should have talked about earlier, is that we talk so much about the animation and the limitations of the medium that we forget about the writing. And overall, it's pretty strong throughout the run.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm and Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And also the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our associate producers of Standard Orbit, Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, and Nick Anastasio. Thank you so much for all your support of both Standard Orbit and Trek FM through Patreon. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701, Norm on Twitter at starfighter1701, and our buddy Aaron Harvey on Twitter at geekfilter. And Nick isn't on Twitter, you can find him on Facebook and of course around the Babel Conference. As for us personally, you can find me on Twitter at moronzach, that's M-O-O-R-E-O-N-Z-A-C-H on Twitter. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, about the Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. As for my regular co-host, Ken Tripp, you can find him on Twitter at BostonSCPO, so look him up on social media there. Well, that's going to do it, folks. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.